Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. Oh, say, can you see? This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this day after Election Day. Happy Kentuckian today is saying that his political compromise is suddenly sipping whiskey for the next 2 years. Listen.
Some things don't change after tonight. I don't expect the president to wake up tomorrow and view the world any differently than he did when he woke up this morning. He knows I won't either. We do have an obligation to work together on issues where we can agree. I think we have a duty to do that. Just because we have a two-party system doesn't mean we have to be in perpetual conflict.
Mitch McConnell, the Kentuckian, who in a few short months will be a Senate Majority Leader. The Senate Majority Leader. There's some votes that have to be counted. The votes say that the Republicans have taken control of the Senate. A real crushing victory. 7-seat pickup. North Carolina, Iowa, who elects a woman for statewide office for the first time, Colorado, West Virginia, Arkansas, Montana, South Dakota. It was a good night for GOP governors as well. Solid gains in the House of Representatives. The Republicans returned to their biggest majority in the House since the 1940s. President Obama has invited party leaders to the White House on Friday to talk about what Congress can accomplish in the next 2 years. Let's see if he can get a word in edgewise at that meeting on Friday. The Senate race in Louisiana is the only one that will go to a runoff, and that's really a surprise. We thought many more runoffs were going to be taking place. We're going to be cliffhangers today. Not the case. Big money spent for these midterms, and for the first time, dollars were showered on some very beleaguered and caught off guard judgeships. We'll be talking about that this hour. It's another twist, yet another twist in the Citizens United narrative. But we begin now with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. And I hope you've curried favor with Mitch McConnell over the last couple of years there, Todd.
Not necessary, but been covering McConnell a long time, and he's got some happy staffers and campaign workers, particularly his campaign manager who came from the Senate, who McConnell said threw a no-hitter in Kentucky.
And what does this mean, do you think, for the Senate? What's the style going to be? He's very, very different than Harry Reid.
Well, he is and he isn't. Mitch McConnell, as people have probably used to hearing, is a master tactician and a great strategist. Now, he's got some choices to make over the next 2 years, and the next 2 years are critical. Mitch McConnell's going to have several senators who want to run for president. He's got to set political votes that give them votes in the best position as possible. President Obama has to do the same thing on his side. Now, the question is, you heard that cut, the things that we can agree on. Both sides, particularly Republicans, who are also unpopular with the public because of their reputation for obstruction. John, now they're governing, and they've got to show they can govern. They need to pass a couple of things. Is that thing going to be sweeping immigration reform? No. I'm here to tell you that that's not going to pass over the next 2 years. The incentives on both sides are probably just not there. What can they agree on? Tax reform, corporate tax reform, probably. And it's looking increasingly like there are plenty of Democrats who would like to vote for the Keystone XL pipeline. That's probably going to land on the president's desk. And he's going to be under some pressure to sign that over the next 2 years.
He'll be under pressure to veto.
Or veto, and a lot of that is going to depend on Democrats who have to run in 2016 and where they want to be positioned on that issue. It's a pretty popular issue with voters, and they do know about it now because of the fights of the last 2 years. It's going to depend on what the Democratic nominee wants to do in terms of their positioning or potential nominee. The other big issue to watch is Obamacare. Can Republicans repeal it? No, they probably can't, and Barack Obama would never sign a full repeal, but there are some aspects of Obamacare that they can probably change and probably repeal that would land on the president's desk that Democrats want to vote for, things like medical device taxes and taxes on insurance plans and things like that.
And again, there'll be some pressure to veto. Who knows what the president will do, and there will be a 60-vote issue suddenly for the Republicans that was so much the case in the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Now, let's talk a little bit about McConnell's responsibility will be to try to compromise with the president. He's already said that. We played that cut. He's going to have to sort of keep the elbows out of his face from people like Ted Cruz, who are looking at 2016, Rand Paul looking at 2016, Marco Rubio looking at 2016. Anybody else in there?
Rob Portman of Ohio, potentially.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, that's another one.
And then there's the issue of the committee assignments. And the big one, it seems to me, is Cornyn in Judiciary. Is that the case?
Probably going to be Chuck Grassley, actually, of Iowa. Longtime 30-year Iowa senator, increasingly conservative over the last few years. A very different agenda, John, than the current chairman, Pat Leahy, the president pro tem of the Senate from Vermont. I think out are going to be a lot of hearings and legislation on voting rights. The stance on immigration is going to change. How will Chuck Grassley react in this interim period? Now, don't forget, the president has promised executive action on immigration. Hey, if he knows that Republicans are taking over the Senate in January, that makes that much more likely, even within the next few weeks. How will Senate Republicans react after January to that? And the other big issue in the near term is a replacement for Eric Holder at Attorney General and potential Supreme Court nominees. In the immediate term, Democrats will still be in the majority, and the president looks likely to try to get through an AG nominee in a lame duck session. How will Grassley react to that? Mm. And then later over the next 2 years, will there be a Supreme Court nomination? I'm not sure that so much has changed in the Senate about that. Is there in this world, let's think about it real quick, is there in this entire world a Supreme Court nominee that this president, with his popularity and his relationship with Republicans, could nominate now that could get 60 votes? Does that change after January? Maybe not much. That would be one heck of a fight.
All right, I want to throw you a wild card. Listen to this.
Thanks to all of you, we are heading to Washington. And we are going to make them squeal.
Senator-elect Joni Ernst from Iowa. Sure. Does she have any sort of Sarah Palin kind of momentum in the Senate?
Well, she's trying not to. You know why? If you would have taken the Joni Ernst of 6 months ago, who came to this race with a really, really, really conservative stance, you would have thought there was maybe someone in a rhetorical Palin mode going to the Senate. She's moderated that throughout this race. She's made herself a mainstream Republican, John. It's a testament to how well Republicans vetted their candidates so that they didn't have far-right candidates who would win primaries and then lose generals. We've seen that movie before. They didn't do that this time. Joni Ernst is going to the Senate. Well, now she's won. She's got 6 years, and we'll see what her positioning is. But she's made herself mainstream.
Very interesting stuff. Todd Zwillich, thanks so much.
You got it.
Boy, wouldn't you like to be on the party conference calls today as strategists set the course for the next 2 years, figure out who they have to pay attention to, who they can ignore, and what all the important money people are saying. Joe Fuld is founder and president of the Campaign Workshop, Democratic political consulting firm. Leslie Sanchez is an author and Republican strategist. Welcome, Joe. Let's begin with you. What do you think?
It was a tough night last night.
I know it was a tough night, but that's not news. What's the strategy going forward?
Well, the strategy in a presidential election is different than a strategy in a off-year election. I mean, I think that, you know, we have, as a party, have to make sure that we have a national message that connects with voters. And I think that, you know, this year we didn't do that. We didn't have that. And you saw that permeating down to the local level as well as on the national level.
And I think, you know, if you're asking me, and I know nothing, right, it seems like there was a lot of focus on will Hillary run, will Hillary not run. There was this avoidance of President Obama, and there was nobody who really emerged as a kind of messenger for the Democrats. And so it really all seemed like a big blank. Am I wrong?
I think that the Republicans did an effective job of defining the election. And yeah, I think that the Democrats didn't have a national message. We didn't. And we tried to localize in these elections, and that wasn't successful.
Maybe the Democrats should embrace Citizens United and start spending the way the Republicans are doing. I've got just a few seconds here. What do you think about that?
Well, there was some spending on the Democratic side like that, but not to the level that the Republicans had.
We're talking political strategy with Joe Fuld, founder and president of the Campaign Workshop, a Democratic political consulting firm. Also, Republican strategist Leslie Sanchez is with us. Leslie, and Joe. Joe's already said it's a tough day. Leslie, you're not going to cackle and giggle for us, are you now?
No, not at all, but I'm very excited.
Yeah, I can hear the smile on your face.
After so many bad election seasons, it's just nice to be able to smile after one of them.
Well, certainly a contrast to 2012, that's for sure. Let's talk about Iowa just for a moment. 8-point victory and the first woman elected to a statewide office. That Iowa result was really a surprise to me. What do you think it means?
I think it's really exciting. I mean, one of the things I was looking at is Republican women overall, and Joni Ernst in Iowa definitely being a big part of that conversation, did very well. There were two things to think about. One, these were stronger women candidates. They were just strong candidates, period, who happened to be women. They didn't run on the so-called feminine agenda or women's issues. They ran more on middle-class issues, economic points. It didn't get into reproductive rights or this war on women, which was very much the tone of the conversation a couple of years ago. So I think that was a smart move. And the gaps you saw were more so on the Democratic side this time around than on the Republican. So better quality candidates ran across the aisle looking at, you know, blue-collar workers, kind of pocketbook issues. Very strong appeal. And I think an interesting thing we're going to see more about in the next few days is how off these polls are, and they continue to be since 2012. We have to really start questioning, and I'm in this business, the methodology, the approach, because for some things that say it's going to be really neck and neck, it turns out to be much more comfortable in the lead. And it's hard to predict, but there is a movement and a need to challenge our science.
Ernst in Iowa is a centrist woman candidate, and Ted Cruz, of course, is a, you know, appeal to the base conservative. Rand Paul is kind of a fringe candidate made tailor-made for the primaries. Joe Full, does a Joni Ernst in Iowa scare you as a centrist candidate in 2016?
No, I don't see that as being see her as being their lead, you know, presidential candidate. But that'll be interesting to see, you know. I've been wrong before, so we will see how that plays out.
Joe, cheer up. It's okay. Come on. Joe, it's going to be fine. Leslie, go down the map for us. So what really excited you about some other of these races?
Well, I'm going to, since I started with women, I'll go ahead and talk about that a little bit. You know, I'm really excited. Just for example, Elise Stefanik, she's the youngest woman to ever be elected to Congress at 30 years old. She's coming from New York, 21, family-owned business, good name. We needed a backbench. We needed a bench on the Republican side, and I think you're starting to see that we're filling that. You had two governors that we didn't hear much about, being Susana Martinez, who I'm a big fan of in New Mexico, and Mary Fallon in Oklahoma, both won re-election. Susana Martinez's name is coming up a lot. I think you're going to hear a lot about her in 2015 and 2016 when we talk about what the 2016 ticket's going to look like. Strong, balanced budget, done really well working across the aisle. She's a you know, it's a quiet name being circulated. Nikki Haley, of course, pulled it out in South Carolina. But there were some very interesting things overall. I think even folks on the right didn't expect to see this wave. And I know we're talking about a wave, but this kind of undercurrent of support on the gubernatorial level, meaning Maryland, and certainly in Illinois, people were excited. So people can read the tea leaves and say whatever they like about it. I certainly think this is to my point, that it was a loss of confidence in the president, and that he was, though he wasn't on the ticket, it very much amplified that his policies were repudiated.
All right, let me add a Midwesterner to that, and we'll get to you, Joe, in just a second here, because I want to hear some of the voices of these actual candidates who we're going to hear a lot more of in the next 2 years. Here's Scott Walker from Wisconsin.
Those big government special interests spent tens of millions of dollars, brought all sorts of ads in here, brought all sorts of attacks, because a few years ago, we took the power away from the Washington-based special interest, and we put it in the hands of the Wisconsin taxpayers.
And here's Colorado's governor, or senator-elect, Cory Gardner.
We have signed up to be the tip of the spear, the vanguard of the movement that is sweeping our nation to pick the shackle of gridlock and to fundamentally change the dysfunction of Washington, D.C., and we have indeed reached that historic day. We have realized the success of that movement.
Joe Fuld, what do you make of those two? It's hard to discern anything from, you know, exuberant victory speeches, but what do you make of Gardner and certainly Walker?
Well, I mean, what I make of it is that I think, again, there was a national message that they were able to seize on, and frankly, a lack of a national Democratic message to help these Democratic candidates out, right, who were running for governor and running across the country, right? So I think that, you know, they were able to seize on this, you know, sort of lack of a Democratic message and frankly, having one. They had one. We didn't.
Leslie, final thought?
Again, I think it goes back to it falls on the shoulders of the president. People felt he was disconnected. Many people want a president who's like a mayor, who's very much engaged, involved. With his popularity below 50%, historically, it creates a lot of problems down ballot. And you saw it. He couldn't campaign with these candidates. There's just a frustration with the establishment in Washington, and the president is right at the top of that effort.
Leslie Sanchez, Republican strategist, Joe Fuld, founder and president of the Campaign Workshop at Democratic Political Consulting Firm. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. What's your political manifesto going into 2016? Kevin?
This is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. Politics should be about the art of the possible. It's high time that our government started working for the public good and left religion and personal morality to churches, mosques, and synagogues. The government should work for the secular good of the public at large and should not attempt to make 319 million people conform to the narrow views of a conservative few.
The chair recognizes Don.
My name is Don Flobeck, and I would love seeing more independent candidates, drastic cuts in campaign spending, term limits on political offices, and reduction of lobbyists. It seems money is driving our country and not the will of the people.
More about that money business. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us all this hour. The election results after the Tuesday, November 4th. Let's talk about judgeships now around the country and the big question of what might happen to the high court in the next 2 years. Joining us is Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society. It seems like two stories here. One, the funding for judgeship races at many levels of the judiciary. That's a big story. And also, there's always the question of what's going to happen to the Supreme Court when the Senate changes hands. How would you gauge which one's more important right now?
That's a very hard question. I think they're both critically important. You know, on the one hand, with the state court elections, we've seen the money that's been spent doubling, and over $207 million was spent in the period from 2000 to 2009. And that's even gone up radically in this last cycle. We're talking lots of money designed to influence how our state court judges rule in cases that may affect us, may affect our lives very directly. And of course, who sits on our national Supreme Court is also of critical importance. There are so many decisions that will come before the court in the next several years where a lot hangs in the balance. I mean, we just have to look at how many cases have been 5-4 decisions with this current court. So what happens when, whether it's either a democratically appointed justice or a Republican appointed justice retires, we could see a whole set of cases be reversed. And certainly some of us think that they should be in some cases like Citizens United and think that they shouldn't be in other cases such as Roe v. Wade.
You sort of identify the real irony here. It's Citizens United that's really driving this narrative of the judgeships. I'm wondering if what we're looking at is a kind of moral majority narrative in the sense that back in the 80s, school board presidents and school board superintendents were packed with conservatives, and that led to a wave of conservative sort of moral majority social issue Republicans who moved into state and then national office. Do you see the state judgeships feeding the federal judiciary and then eventually possibly even the Supreme Court over the next 10, 15 years if this cycle continues?
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's a lot of bang for the buck in the state court system. And the Koch brothers and other dark money groups have moved in to spend millions and millions of dollars to help decide who sits on the state courts. That affects cases involving voting rights, cases involving redistricting, workers' rights issues, minimum wage, sick leave, all sorts of issues that are going to come in front of these state courts. And there's actually the race in Ohio is particularly interesting because one of the sitting justices, Judy French, who's a Republican, apparently said in front of a Republican audience that her job as a state Supreme Court justice was to be a backstop, as she, that's a direct quote, a backstop for the votes of the conservatives in the state legislature and a Republican governor. And, honestly, I don't think any of us think that that's the role of the courts. We have a situation right now where Americans are disgusted by government. And in addition to being ashamed about what goes on in Congress and the state legislatures, now we're going to feel the same way about our state courts. And I think that it's such an unfortunate outcome. At least we should be able to have faith that our courts are fair and unbiased and nonpartisan, no matter who sits on the court.
Cynicism bought with political campaign money generated by the Citizens United decision. Carolyn Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And now a dispatch from one of our reporters in North Carolina. Big Republican victories last night. WFAE's Tom Bullock sent us this report.
After an estimated $111 million was spent on the race between Democrat Kay Hagan and Republican Tom Tillis, it all came down to 46,539 votes.
I know it's late, but I don't know about you all, but I got a little bit of energy I'm running on right now.
That's North Carolina's new U.S. Senator-elect Tom Tillis.
This victory is not my victory. This victory is our victory. Our victory.
This outcome was not a victory for political polls. Kay Hagan had been leading for weeks, albeit by single digits, well within the margins of error. As they say, there is only one poll that matters, and those numbers washed Kay Hagan out of office.
I will always be grateful for the trust that you placed in me and for the chance to serve our great state. Y'all, it has been fabulous.
The GOP added to their supermajorities in both the state House and Senate. A Republican resides in the governor's mansion to boot. In fact, the only branch of government where Democrats made any headway is the judicial branch. Liberal justices won 2 of 4 seats up for election on the state Supreme Court. A third race looks headed for a recount. For The Takeaway, I'm Tom Bullock in Charlotte.
Let's talk money once again. The Citizens United tactics and strategy got their first real crack at a midterm election. And boy, was it interesting to see what the future is going to look like. The present with a lot more zeros. Maybe that's the easy takeaway at this point. Joining us is Keisha Weir, project manager and reporter for Who's Calling the Shots, a project of the Center for Public Integrity's state politics team. What did you think of all the money and the results from yesterday's election?
It was quite impressive. We're, you know, still looking at a couple of seats that haven't been decided yet, but it really was a real Republican victory on the, obviously, the Senate side, but also in the governorships. And there's just a lot of money that was spent on especially TV ads. We have, you know, more than $1.3 billion were spent on U.S. Senate and state level races alone.
Is it amounts of money that matter most, or is somehow money a dynamic that has more of an impact as an opposition force, as a negative force, as a get rid of the bums kind of force?
Well, I think it's both. It really did end up helping. If you had more money on your side, it really helped you win. And in this case, that money was really fueling a lot of throw the bums out sentiment and a lot of anti-Obama rhetoric. If you looked at a lot of the ads, they were, you know, referenced the president and his health care plan, even if it was for a state legislative race in Alabama. And, you know, it's interesting. The money really did seem to have an influence.
You know, we could have a debate over policy, but we're not going to here. But I'm wondering if one of the dynamics going forward and the trends going forward on the Citizens United is that every incumbent president will have a target on his or her head, and the midterm money will basically be to shut down the sitting president, whoever that person may be, and that the concept of coattails kind of goes away.
That's an interesting point. And I think that we, you know, really are going to be seeing a lot more of the kind of message being controlled by people who are outside of the actual candidates because of that. And so they can really shape the message how they want. And if they're the outside groups who are doing, you know, on the state level races, 1 in 5 of the ads are on the Senate side. In some races, they were doing more than half of them. You know, they can really make it be the conversation they want to have based on those dollars that they're able to throw into the ads on the airwaves.
You know, there's going to have to be some research done as to whether the electorate perceives the difference between ads that are specifically endorsed by a candidate and ads that are the dark money candidate. I mean, I can recall hearing ads that were clearly not associated with a candidate and then other ads that were associated with a candidate. I couldn't tell within my own sort of soul which one had more or less of an impact, but I gather that's the next really important sort of statistic to get from the electorate right now.
Yeah, and I think the voters are getting smart about this. You know, they kind of are realizing that there's some of these groups aren't necessarily who they sound like with their nice names, like Coalition for a Better Future or The Future Sounds Great. And, you know, we talked to an expert about the Maryland governor's race, which was a surprise. A Republican, Larry Hogan, beat the lieutenant governor, Anthony Brown. And what we heard was that, you know, a lot of voters were turned off by the negative ads attacking Hogan. And even though it wasn't Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown who made those ads, those outside groups that did some of them, they were, you know, kind of conflated them with Brown. And so that had a kind of dulled the shine off of his race and helped push Hogan forward in a state that is, you know, largely a blue state.
Who do you think was really taken down, sort of nailed in the, you know, carotid artery by the money that came in this midterm election? And who do you think leaves this election with a clear sort of national platform going forward, if you can answer that question?
Yeah, sure. So Charlie Crist in Florida really just got hammered. He was running for governor in Florida, had already served as governor as a Republican, but this time he was running as a Democrat. And he put up a big fight, you know, had a lot of ads in his favor, but he was outspent almost 2-1. Incumbent Governor Rick Scott and his allies spent $61 million on TV ads, and Crist and his allies had only $34 million. And so it was the most expensive race in the country in terms of TV ads. And a lot of those ads were negative ads talking about Charlie Crist, about how he'd changed parties, about his role as governor during the economic crisis. And he really got hammered. On the flip side of the people who kind of shone ahead of all of this, we had, you know, a number of candidates that kind of that knocked out some incumbents, and we had some incumbents that held on and showed their mettle. Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Tom Wolf in Pennsylvania, unseated Governor Corbett. And the governor's races are so interesting because they really set the stage for the presidential election. It's a breeding ground for a lot of the candidates that do decide to run and potentially in 2016.
Well, that's great stuff. I think you're absolutely right. Walker, I think, is the big winner for 2016 on the GOP side at this point. And I think Paul Ryan is probably the big loser in the same state on the 2016 side. We'll just have to see. Keisha Weir, project manager and reporter for Who's Calling the Shots, a project of the Center for Public Integrity State Politics team. Thanks so much, Keisha.
Thanks for having me.
Two voices now on what may suddenly be on hold between now and 2016 and what may actually get accomplished with this shakeup of the political power relationships in the Congress and the White House. On the domestic side, joining us is Theda Scotchpohl, who is professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, director of the Scholars Strategy Network. Theda, what do you think is likely to get accomplished over the next 2 years? Mitch McConnell certainly talked about, oh, we're going to have compromise. There's a meeting on Friday at the White House. What do you think?
Oh, I don't think a great deal will be accomplished over the next 2 years. There will be some areas of policy where the president and the Republican Congress can come to some kind of understanding. I expect there will be budget negotiations rather than a shutdown of the government. There'll probably be some adjustments in the Affordable Care Act after the Republicans hold their flashy repeal votes and those go nowhere. On the other hand, you know, President Obama can still move forward, just as he has been really for the last 2 years, through administrative action on some of the pressing problems facing the country, such as how to handle law-abiding undocumented immigrants. He's likely to act on that front without Congress, and that really isn't a change from before November 4th.
So you'll see trends continuing on immigration. You'll see the Affordable Care Act sort of a show business, but no real effect there. What about the, you know, the theme of the 60-vote rule, which was such a big, huge issue in the first 2 years of the Obama term? Suddenly that's turned now to the Republicans, because if the president uses his veto a lot, then suddenly the Republicans have their own 60-vote problem.
Well, and they will. And, our focus in this election has been on the Senate, but the issue really remains extremists in the House of Representatives. And now there are a set of fairly extreme new senators to join Ted Cruz in the Senate of the United States. So a lot of the drama is actually going to be inside the Republican Party, particularly as jockeying for the nomination for president in the GOP in 2015 and 2016 takes center stage, which it will by the middle of 2015.
So you're going to see a Scott Walker, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, not that Scott Walker's in the Senate or anything, but you're going to see those voices try to battle it out for who's a possible front runner in 2016 for the GOP.
Well, you're going to see competition to see who can be the most extreme in terms of catering to the right wing of the Republican Party, which is the good citizens who turn out. You're right to point to Scott Walker, because in some ways the most important and surprising outcome of the election here was the set of victories for Republican governors. Scott Walker's reelection in Wisconsin was a big deal because he's followed some of the most extreme policies. Also, Tom Tillis, who eked out a victory in North Carolina
right.
over Kay Hagan. One is a governor and the other a senator race that really signal where the Republican Party has moved.
And Walker has completely overshadowed Paul Ryan, it seems like, in the House in terms of having a sort of national status. What do you think of Rand Paul? What do you think of Marco Rubio? Those names that we certainly heard a lot about over the last 2 years.
Well, you know, I actually don't think Marco Rubio is going anywhere. Remember, he's the author of the compromise immigration reform bill, and I don't think conservative activists in the Republican Party will forgive that. Rand Paul has a following, but he's going to have plenty of competition from these tough guy governors and from Senator Ted Cruz, who is likely to be the standard bearer for all-out right-wingism in the coming year and a half.
Theda Scotchbowl is a professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, director of the Scholars Strategy Network. And with a look at the international situation post-election now, Financial Times columnist Edward Luce joins us. Ed, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
So with everything going on, I mean, you've got a new Cold War. You've got ISIS in the Middle East. You've got, any number of problems, Hong Kong protesting in China. Does this divided government in Washington help, hurt, assist in U.S. Involvement in any of these crises, or do we go into a holding pattern?
I think more the latter. Look, the world as a whole, whether you're talking about America's allies in Europe or its opponents in places like Moscow and Beijing, Venezuela, etc., has seen a sort of sense of strategic drift in the last few years under President Obama. I think those who are paying attention know that gridlock stems equally from both parties, if not more from the Republicans. But in terms of President Obama's foreign scope to pursue an active and effective foreign policy and his willingness to do so, there's already deep skepticism about that around the world, and I think Tuesday night's results in the midterm elections will only reinforce it. It'll be seen as more of the same, but a little bit worse.
So even if the president wants to get more involved, he'll be perceived as even more of a lame duck president with much less power and certainly less of a mandate from the legislature in the United States.
That's certainly true. I think, from the perspective of my part of the world, Europe, that there will be some hope that a Republican-controlled Congress would give Obama fast-track negotiating authority to negotiate a big transatlantic trade deal. However, I'm based in Washington, D.C., and I find that pretty unlikely as a prospect. I think the Republicans would be loath to give Mr. Obama such scope to negotiate a deal without their input, having, just won what they see as a wave election and an election that they see as a mandate to repudiate President Obama's agenda. So, there will be nuances depending on which parts of the world are looking at this. But I think overall it'll be seen as a sort of for whom the bell tolls moment for President Obama, 2 years before his presidency officially comes to an end.
What about the talk that John Kerry, Secretary of State, was pushing forward just a few months ago about going around the treaty process to get some important international agreements, if not ratified, moving forward so that some cooperation could take place? Climate change was one of the discussions, and there were certainly some others.
There were some others. I mean, of course, the most important thing on John Kerry's plate is the nuclear talks with Iran. And there's a deadline for those talks to reach agreement later this month. I don't think huge amounts of progress has been made. But Congress, of course, would be involved with that, too. And for any deal to go ahead, President Obama would need to ask Congress to start reducing sanctions on Iran in exchange for Iran dismantling part of its nuclear enrichment process. Will this new Congress be more likely to cooperate with that than less? I would have thought probably less likely to cooperate.
Ed Luce, columnist for the Financial Times, thanks so much for being a part of our election coverage, Ed.
Thank you for having me, John.
Before we end this hour, where do we go from here, folks?
My name is Laura. I'm calling from Lafayette, California. My fondest vision for our political future is that the populace, all of us, wake up, start paying attention, inform ourselves on the issues and on which candidates are most likely to work for us and aren't bent on obstructionist policies and just ensuring their own reelection and their party supremacy. It's up to us, everybody. Let's go.
Catch up on any of the conversations or listen back to anything on the program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry in a free democratic America. And this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.